From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It seemed like an ordinary enough business proposition triggered by demographics. A new Florida broadsheet newspaper called the Gainesville Guardian aimed at the 43% black community of East Gainesville. It also could have been seen as a boon to that community, which previously had no media outlet attuned especially to a black audience. But news of the new weekly quickly provoked an angry response, because the publisher of the Gainesville Guardian is the city's daily, the Gainesville Sun, owned by the New York Times Company. By the time the first issue of the Guardian rolled off the presses on Wednesday, the Times Company stood accused of carpetbagging in Gainesville, taking money out of the pockets of black publishers. Among the more strident critics has been George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which represents 200-some black papers. This week he wrote, "Black people don't need the New York Times or any other white-owned media company to speak for us. We do that quite well ourselves." He joins me now. George, welcome to OTM.
Okay, I would disagree with your description of me as being strident. I'm a well-reasoned person.
Okay, well, fair enough. I'm quoting your column. "It is arrogant and ridiculous to think that newspapers that primarily portray African Americans as criminals, athletes, and entertainers will suddenly be able or willing to present African Americans in their full complexity." Do you think the New York Times Company newspapers, especially the Times itself, is racially tone-deaf, given to stereotypes, dismissive of the black community?
Well, I mean, those are your words, not mine. What I would say is this, that we have failed miserably as an industry to reflect America as it is, either in our coverage and in our staffing levels. The New York Times, for example, its primary circulation area has about 30% people of color. Its news staff is about half that amount. The black press was founded on a totally different mission than the white press. It was founded in 1827 primarily to address the whole question of lynching and the lack of equal rights, and that's been its mission throughout. The New York Times does not have the same mission, and nor should it. And so I'm saying that they cannot do what they're not really trained to do or have an interest. Their interest is very simply economics.
You've said, I'm quoting again here, "equally culpable are companies that refuse to advertise in black-owned media but are willing to place ads with white-owned publications, broadcasts, and internet outlets targeting African-Americans. They should be publicly exposed and boycotted. In fact, every black newspaper should identify them each week so that African-Americans will be able to support only corporations that respect and support them."
I said it for African Americans, I said it for Latinos, I said it for Asian Americans as well. In 2 years, the annual spending rate for people of color would be roughly $5 trillion. It would be almost $1 trillion for African Americans alone. So you have companies coming in and they want you to be great consumers. They also have a responsibility beyond just taking in our dollars, and that's my point.
Are you suggesting that corporations are institutionally racist somehow, that they're not advertising in black-owned papers because they're black-owned?
See, again, those are your words, not mine. What I am saying, I've said very clearly, they have a responsibility to advertise in mediums used by their consumers. You look at the survey after survey that shows that African-Americans, Latinos, or Asian-Americans trust their publications more than the daily press. And so I'm saying that I don't think that advertisers who are relying and exploiting and targeting certain segments of the audience, like African-American, should avoid advertising in the newspapers and radio and TV stations. That's just simply fairness.
Fair enough. But how does the New York Times publishing a newspaper for a predominantly black audience affect what advertisers are doing at black-owned newspapers?
With the clout that the New York Times has, when they move in, they already have a relationship with the major advertisers in that region. And when the advertisers have a choice between spending money with the New York Times or that local black press, my fear is that they're going to exclude the black press.
Your position troubles me, because if black audiences are to be addressed only by black owners, isn't that in effect putting a colored-only sign on media properties?
You missed the point. That's not what I said. What I said was that companies that exploit and target segments of the economy, i.e. African-Americans, Latinos, and Asians, should advertise in the mediums that they trust. I'm not saying only advertise there, but I'm also saying don't exclude them if they're trusted and respected by their readers.
Doesn't the fact that newspapers are addressing the demographic shifts with properties aimed to serve individual ethnic communities doesn't that suggest a future that will be more representative of various constituencies that make up America?
Not necessarily. If you're talking about the Gainesville paper, we're having a circulation of 10,000 versus the local paper having a circulation of 47,000 to 50,000, what are you really serving there? That's not the solution to me. The solution is make the regular local paper representative of the entire community. I think it's an attempt to absolve themselves of their main responsibility. And I don't think they're doing it for editorial reasons. I think they're doing it for economic reasons.
Well, George, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Bob.
George Curry is editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association and also a frequent contributor to NPR's News and Notes with Ed Gordon. Joining us now is the publisher of the Gainesville Sun and the new Gainesville Guardian, Jim Doughton. Jim, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what do you make of all of the fuss?
Well, I think some of it has been a bit overblown. The Guardian, coming out this week, it's a community weekly newspaper. It's sort of part of our fundamental strategy to reach out to a broader market, and especially trying to reach non-subscribers to the Daily Gainesville Sun. East Gainesville does have a very high ethnic black population, and so naturally we're going to serve that in the same manner that you would serve an area if we had a high retiree community that lived in East Gainesville.
We spoke to George Curry. He said that he believes, at least in part, that the Gainesville Guardian is an attempt for the New York Times Company to cover the black community in the weekly paper so it can only continue doing a shabby job covering the black community in the Daily Gainesville Sun.
The Gainesville Sun has won two Pulitzer Prizes, which is unusual for a newspaper this size, and both of those were on editorial writing on African-American issues. So we're proud of that. With that said, it's fair to say that most mainstream newspapers could do a better job of targeting the different ethnic audiences. So I am not going to say that we have done a perfect job in that regard because we are spread out over such a large geographic area. But I am proud of the record of this newspaper in terms of the positions that we've taken on African-American issues in the past and will take in the future.
One of the reasons that some critics seem to be seething is what they perceive as the certainty that the New York Times-owned Gainesville Guardian will have more success getting advertising dollars than black-owned newspapers have been in trying to reach the same audience. Do you think they're right in those suspicions?
I think if we were coming in and there was already an existing publication there that we were perhaps trying to compete directly with, I could understand more of that concern. There was no one serving this market.
Another thing that Mr. Curry said was that the role of the black newspaper is slightly different from that of the mainstream newspaper in that it incorporates both a news function and an advocacy function. As you have devised the Gainesville Guardian, will it embrace the values that other black papers have embraced throughout the United States?
I think that's a real fair question. The answer to that would be no. We won't be advocating any point of view. We'll continue to listen to the community and see what suggestions they have. And we'll probably, you know, as we do with all products, modify those as we move into the future.
Well, Jim, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much.
Jim Doughton is publisher of the Gainesville Sun and the brand new hot off the presses Gainesville Guardian.
Last week in our letters section, I read letters from listeners upset that I'd spoiled the ending of Million Dollar Baby, to which I responded, "Where's the statute of limitations on this thing?" And thereupon we spoil the endings of The Crying Game, Psycho, and Citizen Kane. That prompted more letters from irked listeners who suggested that a simple apology would have been classier. I agree. So permit me to say that I am sorry, and I will try not to do it again. Then it occurred to me that, though I may be able to avoid it, reviewers have to deal with this problem all the time. In fact, New York Daily News TV reviewer David Biancooley had just written a column on it, so I called to ask him how he handles it.
I really try to write all of my reviews about programs that are in advance without spoiling even good jokes and certainly plot twists, because I want the viewers to be as surprised as I am when I saw it. But at some point, to talk about why that movie is good or bad or why it resonates with audiences, somebody's got to be able to say, here's why.
Now, you devoted a whole column to the issue of spoilers, and you said in the age of TiVo, you can never satisfy everybody.
And it gets worse, because there are people, and I like these people, who say there's so much junk on commercial network television regarding the commercials that they wait for the DVDs for a TV experience. Well, that's fine, but I work for a newspaper, you work for the radio, and we get to talk about these things a little bit sooner than the last person who saves the last chocolate in the box.
What do you propose a frustrated listener or reader do?
Well, only that person knows what his or her timetable is for enjoying something. And if you're not going to watch your Six Feet Under episode for 3 weeks, then, you know, stack up the newspaper articles, turn off the radio when you hear it mentioned, so that you do get that experience. I do that when I saw Million Dollar Baby. I knew something was going on, and it was in headlines and it was in op-ed pieces, but I just stacked those up until I could get to it and enjoy it myself. So you can do it if you want to, if it means that much. And if it doesn't mean that much, then don't make such a fuss. It's insane to me. Once it's been broadcast, as far as I'm concerned, it's out there.
So for movies, what would you say the statute of limitations should be?
Well, since most movies, unless they're giant hits, disappear from the multiplexes within 2 or 3 weeks, if I were a film critic and I wanted to come back and really talk about The Sixth Sense as a perfect example, I would say a couple of weeks is fair. Certainly you don't have to wait for a video release or any subsequent window.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot. I feel your pain.
David Bianculli is a reviewer for the New York Daily News, who can also be heard on NPR's Fresh Air.
Good luck with this one. It's a losing battle, I fear.
From spoiling endings to arguing over beginnings, the conundrum of covering intelligent design. That's up next, and also why Google's buying a pipeline near you.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last May, the Kansas State Board of Education held hearings on proposed changes to its curriculum standards, namely that evolution should be taught as a controversial scientific idea, not as a universally accepted one. Over 3 days, more than 20 witnesses, all supportive of the curriculum change, offered testimony that natural selection had both critics and competing theories, including intelligent design, and argued that students should learn about them all in biology class. Pro-Darwinian forces sent no witnesses, but rather an attorney who called for the dissolution of the hearings and played the role of cross-examiner. In the language of the proceedings, he was the representative of, quote, mainstream science, which effectively staged a boycott. If mainstream science can opt out of the debate, the mainstream media doesn't have that luxury.
Should intelligent design be taught alongside the theory of evolution? We'll have a special report and a debate.
And when the president weighs in, as he did on August 1st, saying that both sides ought to be properly taught, even a pseudo-debate rises unambiguously to the status of news. The question for journalists is not whether to cover it, but how. Just last month, NPR's science correspondent David Kestenbaum wrestled with the story, and he joins me now. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So months ago on this show, we had on the editor of Scientific American, John Rennie, and he said that journalists make a fetish out of balance. In other words, if a source says X, reporters will inevitably get somebody else to say Y. And Rennie believes that this is very often inappropriate when applied to stories about science.
Well, I think we agree with that. I mean, if you take something like climate change, I think in stories what you'll hear is that the vast majority of scientists believe that humans are changing the climate and causing the planet to get warmer. And then the story might say something like, there are some people who do disagree with that, and here's one of them. But you would try and set the scale of both sides. One of the things I really like about covering science is that, you know, there is an answer. It's not like politics where anybody's opinion may have some merit. Any question that can be posed scientifically is something that can be tested and can be proven right or wrong.
I feel humbled arguing this with you, David, but the fact is there are things that are theories before they become fact.
For sure. And, you know, it's your job as a journalist to say where each theory is. But, you know, evolution is as much of a fact as you get in the scientific world. That's an assumption in a lot of stories we do. Any story which discusses whether the avian flu virus could evolve, jump into humans and maybe kill a lot of people, you don't say, you know, if evolution is right. When you do a story about genetics and mentioning that humans and chimps share some 99% of their DNA, the line that will come after that is because they branched off from the evolutionary tree relatively recently.
But you reported a story recently on NPR about the debate between evolutionary biologists and advocates of intelligent design, many of whom believe that life is so improbably complex that there simply must be a creator. So was this a story that was full of minefields for you?
It was, and we thought a lot about how to approach it. And the solution I had was that we should push the problem off onto the scientists and talk about why it was the scientists didn't like to debate in an open forum, originally the creationists, and now don't like to debate the intelligent design people. And it became a discussion about how the mainstream scientific community had chosen to deal with something which they view as completely non-scientific.
I'm reminded of a piece in The New Yorker a few months back by a science professor named H. Allen Orr. What he did was he took each of the various subgroups of the intelligent design theory and then explained why they simply couldn't hold water. This is precisely the sort of thing that I think a lot of scientists and perhaps a lot of science reporters wish that people wouldn't do, because by talking about these theories, you present them as if they offer a viable alternative to evolution, and they don't.
We got emails to that effect afterwards. I got some emails from, I suppose, who you might call creationist types, who said, thank you for pointing out that the scientists don't like to debate us because clearly they're wrong. And we got emails from people saying, why didn't you stand up and defend evolution? We didn't want to get into that because, you know, we thought that raised it unfairly as something that deserved sort of scientific debate.
But obviously, plenty of people out there need to have it explained all over again, or else they will lend it the same sort of false equality that one might say the president did when he remarked that both sides ought to be properly taught. So don't you, as a reporter, have an obligation to explain evolution again?
I'll tell you, there's a little piece of paper by my desk, and it has stories to do. And one is a 3.5-minute defense of evolution. I mean, one of the things that came up when I was doing that story is the scientist said, well, look, it's just so hard to explain in, they said, an hour of a debate. And I thought, are you kidding me, an hour? And I thought, all right, well, this is my job then to try and find the greatest examples and jam them into 3.5 minutes. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, let's talk about this piece that you just did with two primary sources, one a biology professor from Brown University who's squarely in the pro-Darwin camp, and the other a biochemist at Lehigh University who's a big proponent of intelligent design. So how did you structure the story so as not to lend a kind of he said, she said equality that Jonathan Rennie at the Scientific American says is inappropriate?
Well, I think there's actually a nice little moment in that story. I'm talking to the intelligent design advocate, and I say, so what's it like being an intelligent design guy at an academic university? And he goes, it's pretty lonely. And, you know, he laid it out there. You didn't need me to say, I've counted and there are 10 million scientists on this side and five on the other. And I thought the real question behind the story, when you look at, as you mentioned, the case in Kansas, how the scientific community decided to deal with it or not deal with it. And in some ways, I think that's more interesting than the back and forth who's right.
The New York Times has recently run a multi-part series under the heading A Debate Over Darwin. Do you think reporters run the risk of legitimizing what most consider to be pseudoscience by giving it too much attention?
Yeah, I do think that's a danger, and that's why we decided to handle the story the way we did. It's interesting. I've been reading some blogs by scientists who are unhappy with parts of the New York Times story, and then Kenneth Chang, who wrote one of them for the New York Times, has then been entering into a debate on the blogs with the scientists saying, but look what I said in these thousand words of my story here. It's true the first paragraph says what you say, but look at the rest of my story. And that's the hard part for journalists, is that people hear what they want to hear a lot of time, or people hear what they don't want to hear.
These poor science reporters, they ought to try covering the Middle East for a while. David, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
David Kestenbaum is a science reporter for National Public Radio.
More than 6 months ago, Business 2.0 writer Om Malik noticed a job posting at Google, and he was interested, not in the job, but in what the new position suggested might be a foot at Google. So he commenced to dig. What he discovered as he made his way through his Rolodex of contacts was that Google had been quietly shopping for the past year and buying up unused fiber optic cable, or dark fiber, all around the country. What does that mean? Well, dark fiber is cable that has been laid out but not connected to anything. During the telecom boom of a decade ago, it was planted by the thousands of miles, but rendered worthless by the subsequent telecom bust. The fact that Google was buying this fiber up at pennies on the dollar suggested to Malik that Google may be building out a vast network of its own, maybe even a parallel internet that could, among other things, circumvent existing internet service providers. And if it owns such a network, Malik calls it GoogleNet, the company could set up Wi-Fi hotspots in commercial districts to give internet service away for free. That would give Google advertisers exclusive access to consumers at the point of consumption. Anyway, Malik says, that's how he figures it.
They are building a GoogleNet, which is basically connecting the Google infrastructure worldwide. Think of it as a parallel internet which Google owns. The way most of the internet works right now is that when you come to Google, whether you're using your DSL or cable connection, you use the cable provider's network to get to Google. So at some point, somebody has to pay for the usage of network. And more bandwidth is going to be consumed, Google will need more and more bandwidth. So the idea is to build out your own infrastructure. This way, Google doesn't pay anyone for using their networks.
What does it mean for me, the internet broadband consumer?
They will use these assets they're buying to come closer to the end user being you. And whether it means by striking up special arrangements with, people like Comcast and SBC, or if it means offering free Wi-Fi in places like commuter stations or sports stadiums or public libraries or shopping districts. The idea is that the closer they get to you, the more targeted advertising they can offer. And, that makes advertisers happy. What it means for you is it'll be nice to get free access, wherever you are. I mean, you can actually enjoy the sunshine and check your email or look up information on the go. We've seen it time and again. If you have access, you certainly find new ways to use that connection. So if, let's say, you're in San Francisco's Union Square and you're searching for denim, and the local search results can easily say there is a Levi's store, which is like maybe two blocks away. So suddenly the value of Google actually goes up tremendously.
Okay, so it's not universal free broadband access, but opportunities for consumers to hook up to Wi-Fi hotspots paid for entirely by Google in various places around the country.
That's correct.
What does it do to change the competitive balance among Google, Yahoo, and, say, MSN?
In the future, as more and more high bandwidth applications come online, Google will 5 years from now will look very smart for having done this. Because the cost of bandwidth, even if it's falling, is going to become a major cost for everyone.
I'm curious about any antitrust issues attached to this project, because let's say Google is offering free Wi-Fi hotspots at places around the country. Could that be interpreted as predatory pricing? After all, free is the most predatory price of all.
I don't think so. I mean, anybody can do this. You know, Yahoo can do this. Microsoft can do this. They haven't done it. It's simple as that. It's not as dark as it seems.
These guys are really smart, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, they are the sharpest knives in the drawer, as they say. I mean, they have it all figured out. And I was caught by a surprise when I started chasing down this story. Like, anybody could have thought of this, but not many people did. So my respect for Google has gone from 10 to 100 in 6 months.
Okay. Well, congratulations on the scoop, and thanks very much.
Hey, thank you, Bob.
Om Malik is a senior writer for Business 2.0 magazine. PayPal, the online payment service, did what few of its contemporaries were able to do. It survived the dot-com bust to become the undisputed leader of payments for eBay auctions and many other online transactions. Now PayPal is owned by eBay and is naturally thriving. But that has meant certain business expediencies, such as the regulation of content on the websites it serves, that the company's founders certainly never envisioned. Eric Jackson, author of the new book, The PayPal Wars, was with the company in its formative years, and he joins us now. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
First, briefly, what is PayPal and how does it work?
What PayPal does is it treats your email address as sort of your unique identifier, because every email address is obviously unique. And then you can take this account that you've created, hook up your credit card or even your bank account if you want to, and put money into the account and send it to someone, really anyone with an email address, and that's all you need to know. You don't need to know their private information, their bank account number, their address, even how to spell their name. There are over 72 million people today that use the service, and they use it predominantly for eBay auctions, but also really to send money to just about anyone in the world for just about anything you can imagine.
I understand that it was the core of the founder's vision for PayPal to be a means for individuals to exchange currencies free of government regulation to protect them from, among other things, the vagaries of government monetary policies. Is that right?
The founders of PayPal were a couple of libertarians who really, in the backdrop of the late 90s, looking out at the world and seeing all of these currency crises that spread through Southeast Asia and much of the developing world, and they saw a real need to empower people, especially in instances where governments were causing hyperinflation, to really wipe out the savings of the populace, meanwhile forbidding people from taking money out of their bank accounts. PayPal originally envisioned it would allow people to really move money anywhere in the world, in any currency in the world, and give even the poorest consumer, once they had access to the internet, a virtual offshore account where they would have greater control over their own money.
So it sure would be ironic if, in its present state, PayPal itself were in the regulation business.
It is ironic that PayPal has begun to put some restrictions on different types of uses of the service. Soon after eBay acquired PayPal, they got PayPal out of the business of doing virtual gambling and use of PayPal for adult content. And also, I believe recently, they've outlawed certain types of other transactions, including that for medical equipment and drugs, and also for cigarettes.
And there was a case, if I'm not mistaken, where people's websites were barred from using PayPal because they simply linked to content that PayPal deemed objectionable. I think it was some terrorist videos of beheadings.
I believe that was the case. I read about that as well. It sounded as if it was an instance where it was someone not necessarily promoting terrorism, but rather that had content on his website or his blog to discuss about these type of current event issues that PayPal apparently found objectionable. So this really is a very different sort of policy that PayPal is now pursuing than the one originally envisioned by its founders.
Now, before we get all self-righteous here, let's just talk about the real world for a moment. Not only does a parallel banking system facilitate, say, online gambling and porn, it would be pretty much made to order for money launderers or other perpetrators of organized crime, drug traffickers, terrorists? I mean, what company wants wittingly or unwittingly to be essentially a courier for criminals?
That's a very good point, and obviously no company does. PayPal took a stand against this sort of criminal activity being conducted in its system from early days. Overseas criminal rings that were using PayPal early on to do money laundering, to take their stolen credit card numbers, put them into PayPal, and get cash out, which they could then wire to a bank. And so PayPal has really from almost day one worked to capture these sorts of criminals, to block this type of activity, and to really look for unusual usage of the system without really policing content.
If PayPal should decide that for one reason or another it's unhappy with what content's on my site, what recourse do I have?
Well, certainly you can appeal to PayPal, and they do have an appeals process in their customer service department. But if the outcome is still not in your favor, the only solution is to look elsewhere. And there aren't very many other options out on the market. PayPal really has defeated most of the competitors that have come along.
Do you think PayPal represents some sort of archetype, you know, a quintessential example of what happens when the ideals behind the internet become compromised by the reality of having to keep a lot of various interests happy?
Certainly in the case of online gambling, something that Congress annually debates but does nothing about, for companies like PayPal that were operating in kind of a void where not all the laws are spelt out, there have been instances where regulators such as New York Attorney General Eliot Spitzer have moved in and really tried to influence what the company does. I think one issue that's being hotly debated, though, is are companies such as eBay and PayPal going further than what's being required of them by governmental entities? Are they taking a stance where they're actually editorializing in some way or another? And I think that is what many of its users have complained about.
Well, Eric, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Eric Jackson is the author of The PayPal Wars, Battles with the Media, the Mafia, and the Rest of Planet Earth.
Coming up, amateurs insert themselves into novels and museum audio guides.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. New media technology in the hands of an engaged citizenry has been breaking down institutional walls. Blogging, podcasting, cell phone cameras, bandwidth galore. It all allows just plain Joe to become a journalist, a commentator, or an entertainer. Now, and when you think of it, it seems inevitable, the democratization of media is being applied to museum audio tours.
This painting is at the very best a third-rate painting. The composition is what my grandmother used to call umgepatschka, which means in Yiddish overcrowded, and my grandmother never even made it to the Met. She was lucky to get out of Macy's during a white sale.
That's Lee Siegel's audio commentary produced for Slate about Fernand Léger's 1929 painting Still Life, which hangs in New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. Why rent the museum's stodgy, bulky audio guide when you can download Siegel on your iPod and hear about his grandmother for free? But it was really Professor David Gilbert who came up with the concept of a podcast alternative audio guide when he started a group called Art Mobs and assigned his students to remix the Museum of Modern Art. Cheryl Stover is one of the students who worked on the project. She did a commentary about Picasso's portrait of women in a brothel, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, with her art history teacher, Jason Rosenfeld. Cheryl, Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, first the basics. Jason, what is Art Mobs?
It essentially was a podcasting project at Marymount Manhattan College, where the students did recordings for Professor David Gilbert's class in communication arts to do tours of MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art.
Our assignment basically was to come up with an audio guide that could relate to people that normally wouldn't necessarily get an audio guide to the museum because they found it dry or uninteresting or whatever their reasons were. The reason we did the podcast the way we did was because it was the irreverence was what drew younger people to the museum and to these different pieces and, you know, got them thinking about them in different ways that they wouldn't have before.
Well, let's get down to particulars here and talk about how your Art Mobs audio commentary differs quite extensively from that of MoMA's. And I think we could use the famous Picasso picture, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, that has five women, naked, angular. A couple of them are standing in rather blatant positions, and two of them appear to have sort of African masks for faces. Here's a little slice of the MoMA guide.
Some people have spoken about Picasso's discovery of African tribal art. The figures at the right, one above the other, were repainted after Picasso had looked at examples of African tribal art with its magical qualities. Other people have spoken of his ambivalent feeling towards women and the sense of these unpleasant-looking women looking at the observer has been associated to the idea of disease, linking sexuality to not only pleasure but fright.
I have to admit, I kind of like that old duffer. I think he's helping me understand that picture. What do you think of it, Cheryl?
Oh, no, definitely. But were I to listen to that for 7 or 10 minutes, I might drift off.
7 to 10 minutes.
It would take you less time than that, Jason?
I think so. You know, John Elderfield is a senior curator at MoMA, and he's a terrific scholar and curator, and he's the person narrating that. He's giving you the sense that what you are listening to is the spoken truth of modern art. And I think that there's totally a place for that. But what we thought to do was to do it in two ways differently. The first way was to have a conversation. And the second thing was to liven it up.
Actually, you know what? I've read some stuff about this painting. It's actually about STDs.
It's about STDs?
Yes.
Because you can get STDs from going to a whorehouse?
True. Or syphilis. And people in the 19th century, the early 20th century, were obsessed by sexually transmitted diseases. They didn't have condoms.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
There were people dying of these kinds of diseases all the time. And Picasso was obsessed by it as well. In these kinds of paintings of these women who, the two in the middle look kind of cute, but the ones on the side are quite demonic.
Well, they have syphilis.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
The content that you're getting about the artists and what the picture is, quote unquote, about is all real, is all true. But we are, I wouldn't want to say masking it, because we're sort of interweaving that with a discussion which is quite different from the sort of dulcet tones and the sense of magnitude that you get in these audio guides.
Throughout the course of this project, have you listened to other alternative audio art commentaries, and are there any that stick out for you?
Well, we didn't listen to any before because they didn't really exist. I mean, this is honestly something that has now started to bubble a little bit in the wake of this project.
Well, the one thing I can say where I got inspiration from was The Daily Show. Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert did a great piece on the Gates.
Let's just stop for a moment here and say that this was an enormous project, a series of huge orange curtains running across like ley lines all through Central Park, one of the projects of the famous artist team Christo and Jean-Claude.
Yes. Well, Stephen Colbert sort of made fun of them.
The Gates posits a chromatic orgy. This riot of color achieves a rare re-defamiliarization with the nature of place-time, the whatness of our awareness. No longer framed. I'm sorry, I've run out of crap.
There's an old saying that war is too important to be left to the generals. Do you think that art's too important to be left to the art historians?
No. The art historians
speaking
can
as
never,
an art historian.
ever be replaced. No, it's the right question, I think, because works of art are made in the main for the mass public. At least they are today, you know, and they're meant to comment on society and be a vibrant aspect of society. And we should be able to, academics and, you know, laymen alike, should be able to find a way to engage with art that is not intimidating.
So you've sort of democratized the Museum of Modern Art. I never thought it could be done.
Actually, a French writer in one of the newspapers in France actually wrote that when our project first came out. It's a really cool way of looking at it.
Thank you so much, Cheryl Stover.
Thank you.
And Jason Rosenfeld, thanks to you.
Thanks very much.
Cheryl Stover is a student and Jason Rosenfeld an assistant professor at Marymount Manhattan College. They have their audio tour and MoMA has its. Deborah Schwartz is the Deputy Director of Education at the Museum of Modern Art. She says the usage of MoMA's audio guides is way up.
We have about 33% of our visitors using audio guides at the moment. A third of our audience. That has been true since about July 1st, when we were able to offer people audio tours for free. Prior to that, it was about 5%. What we've done is actually taken the audio that we have in the museum available to people, and we've put it both on our website, and we've also made an arrangement with iTunes so that people can, in fact, if they want to, download for free from iTunes our audio guides and have them on their own MP3 players.
You know, one group that seems to have gotten the ball rolling even faster, and they used MoMA as their subject, is something called Art Mobs. Have you heard any of their alternative tours?
I certainly have. We were intrigued by it. We thought it was a fabulous teaching tool. We saw the possibilities, particularly within the context of a college or university, but also for the context of a very young population that's using iPods and other MP3 players all the time. So we, of course, immediately went to their site and started to listen to what they had done. It's very funny. Part of what's so delightful about it, actually, is they're having fun. And embedded in the sort of comedy routine they're doing are lots of bits and pieces of truth, lots of things about either Picasso or the picture that are actually real pieces of information about it. So I actually think it's quite delightful. And it is interesting. It is certainly not the perspective that the museum would put on our audio guide, has put on our audio guide. It's not the kind of tone. But I think it's kind of wonderful.
But, I mean, what happens if these sort of more fun, less authoritative versions begin to overtake the authoritative ones? Would MoMA then become concerned?
I guess we're not really concerned. It's hard for me to imagine that this eclipses completely the desire for people to have also somebody who has studied and has a sort of scholarly perspective on the work. It just doesn't seem likely to me. In fact, it seems to me that it enhances the possibilities for people's engagement.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Deborah Schwartz is the Deputy Director for Education at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City.
The Demoiselle d'Avignon was, in fact, the most carefully prepared picture that Picasso ever painted.
What do you think about the women in these paintings?
I think they're all naked.
How to become a character in a novel. There used to be only one way, to be acquainted with a novelist and then be enough of a jerk or a wretch or a weirdo that the author expropriates your quirks to immortalize in fiction. But now there is another way. Submit the winning bid in an eBay auction next month and some of America's most famous novelists will name a character in one of their upcoming books after you. All proceeds will go to the Oakland-based nonprofit group The First Amendment Project, a cause close to the heart of Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Chabon. Inspired by a similar but smaller name auction by novelist Neil Gaiman, Chabon successfully, to use his phrase, roped in 15 other authors for the fundraiser, including Stephen King, Dave Eggers, and John Grisham. Michael Chabon, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Artists don't typically like to surrender any control over their creations. Was it difficult to do the roping?
I ran into a little resistance here and there. There definitely were a few authors who just could not bring themselves to surrender even that relatively small degree of control. And that's something I sympathize with completely. You know, names seem relatively insignificant perhaps to the reader, but most writers I know take a lot of time with their characters' names. And in fact, a character's name, if chosen properly, can really enrich a novel. It can add a dimension of, you know, symbolism.
I think they can actually inform the personalities of the character.
Oh, absolutely.
Grady Tripp, to use one of yours, this self-destructive and irresponsible novelist from The Wonder Boys.
Right.
I mean, let's say some guy named Howard Rutstein had bought the name. Could Howard Rutstein have been such a self-indulgent stoner? What about Uriah Heep, Tom Jones, Don Quixote?
Uriah Heep, I mean, when you cite that, you know, Charles Dickens, I think Dickens might be the perfect place to look for a kind of instantaneous understanding of just how important characters' names can be. They're just perfectly named in almost every case, you know, Micawber, Pickwick, and so on. It is important. I think that's part of the reason why this auction is, in a sense, worth doing, and that it's not like auctioning off the rights to, I don't know, have the spine of the book be colored to the choice of the person who's the highest bidder. I mean, you actually are winning something that is at least modestly meaningful. It does mean something to me, and it obviously meant something to the writers who, in spite of their love for the First Amendment, still weren't willing to give it up.
Do you think you'll create a character out of whole cloth just to accommodate the auction?
You never know. I mean, I know Amy Tan has told me that when she did this for a local fundraiser, originally she intended to bestow this name on a relatively minor character, but the name that was the winning name, she loved it so much that she ended up turning it into a significant character in the novel.
Well, you know, I myself am a very literary person, and last year I was watching Desperate Housewives, and there was a scene in which, out of just nowhere, for no apparent reason that had anything to do with the plot, a brand new Buick showed up in a scene because General Motors had paid for the product placement.
Yeah.
You see where I'm going with this?
Are you asking me, like, what if Steve Jobs is the winning bidder? And
for example, I mean, just how do we avoid the total non sequitur aspect of a winning entry altering the novel in an unsatisfactory way?
Well, that can happen too. And I think most of the authors have been careful to reserve the right to, in some way or another, use the name as they see fit. There is a slight open-endedness to this because it's entirely possible that you might get a name that in itself is a fine name for a character but just can't possibly work in whatever it is you have going right now. I'm writing a novel now that's set in a hypothetical Yiddish-speaking district of the United States that was created during the Second World War. You know, all of the characters have names that are typical European Jewish names. So if, you know, Jim Johnson or something were the winning bidder, I would have a really hard time fitting him and his name into this book I'm working on now. And in that case, I will just save it for the next one.
Now, if this is successful, raising funds for the First Amendment Project, is there a logical next step? I mean, I'm thinking of FedEx Field and the Staples Center. Do I have to worry about a Delta Airlines Adventures of Cavalier and Clay?
This has been tried, as you may be aware. Not so many years ago, Faye Weldon wrote what I believe was a short novel, more or less at the behest of Bulgari, the perfume and jewelry people, in which the names of Bulgari and its various products were liberally salted through this novel, and Bulgari paid Faye Weldon to do this. And so what you're talking about has already been attempted. I think it suffers from one really grievous conceptual error, which is, you know, that works of fiction have the prominence and ubiquity to make them really effective and viable means of advertising products. You know, I can remember the era where paperback books had ads in them. There would be an ad for True Cigarettes, for example, right in the middle of the paperback book. And I don't think readers responded very favorably, or else perhaps proving my theory, it just was a totally ineffectual way of trying to advertise something because those ads disappeared and you don't see them anymore.
One final thing. Speaking of names, more or less by accident, I discovered that our daughters are both named Ida Rose. What are the odds?
You're kidding me. Your daughter's name is Ida Rose?
You know, every other Ida Rose in America, apart from your daughter and mine, are 99 and a half years old. We have the only two Ida Roses under the age of 6, I'm sure, in the world.
I think you're right. That's amazing.
All I'm saying is, with respect to Ida, keep her name out of any future novels, will you, bud? Michael, thank you so much. I appreciate you joining us.
Oh, thanks a lot, Bob. Good talking to you.
Michael Chabon is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. The auction for his character's name begins September 1st. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Sarah Dalsimer and Rob Weisberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, also on the iTunes podcast directory. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting the Mostly Mozart Festival, and the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.